Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. How do the relationships between national and ethnic identity, wealth and poverty, past and present, play into who we are and what we do at any given moment? Such questions are woven in different ways into the 10 short stories in author Dagoberto Gilb's new collection of short stories, Before the End, After the Beginning. Gilb's characters include a now respectable man reconnecting with a troubled friend, a boy with ambivalent feelings about his mother's romantic relationships, and a Mexican-American musician both disturbed by an Anglo contractor's treatment of his immigrant employees and pleased to get his house painted for a bargain. Dagoberto Gilb is executive director of the Centro Victoria Center for Mexican-American Literature and Culture, and he's writer-in-residence at the University of Houston. He's in town for a book signing this evening at 6:30 at the Barnes & Noble store on Northwest Highway in Dallas. Loretta, welcome to Think.
Thank you so much for inviting me.
So these stories are all sort of snapshots of people's just moments in their lives. And as you conceive a character, I'm curious about how you decide exactly where you'll jump into his life and where you'll jump back out again.
Well, that's a good question. I guess, you know, you call them snapshots, and that's a good way of saying it. I actually, what I love about short fiction is what I also love about poetry. You start with an image, that is what you work with, an image, and or in fiction an ending, and you work around that. If it's the end, you work and find out where it begins. An image, you sort of pile up around that, and the characters themselves. I tend to go first person a lot, and it's because I want to find a voice. And so when I think I know a voice, that's when I usually have a story. And, you know, with the image, the ending, and the character's voice, I'm usually ready to go.
Are you thinking in that voice throughout the project? Because, you know, reading these, some of them are really well-educated and some aren't. And obviously that's reflected in sort of their speech and the cadence of what they say.
Yeah, no, you know, I try to inhabit them.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you have to become kind of schizophrenic when you're a writer. You have to have hear lots of voices. It's funny, you know, I give readings, and oftentimes when I'm writing, it is not me. And it's a little disturbing to have to read a character from that point of view and hear me. And I'm like, no, this isn't right. The voice that actually should be reading is like my friend Danny. You know, Danny should be here right now.
So do you try to act them out when you're giving a reading?
No, I don't try to do that. I mean, I just get used to doing it in that voice. I try to pick at a reading a story that I feel comfortable that I can read. I try not to pick third person because, you know, if you have dialogue and two different people are talking, I feel odd. But I usually go with a first person point of view story that I can read out loud.
Are you thinking at all about the out loud presentation? I mean, short stories in particular, even when the author is not present, in so many ways lend themselves to being read aloud.
I love short fiction readings when they're good.
Mm-hmm.
Oftentimes some really good writers are not good readers. And actually I used to consider myself, well, I started, I was real bad. And then I actually think I was good at one point. Now I'm a little less certain about how I am.
Really?
Because of the damage that has happened to my body. So I'm a little less certain. I did give a reading yesterday, my first reading on this book tour was yesterday, and I feel like I did okay. So it is helpful for readers, short story, because you have a beginning and an end, and you know, it usually a story usually isn't longer than a half an hour. It can go 10 minutes, you know, depending on the story. So it helps for, you know, the audience to see a beginning and end.
So you mentioned the damage to your body. Was it 2 years ago that you had a stroke?
A little over two and a half, mm-hmm. About two and a half, yeah.
You look great, but obviously it wasn't easy to get from where you were to where you are now.
Yeah, well, you know, you don't want to complain too much. It was awful.
Mm-hmm.
And, but, you know, one of the things you realize is that, you know, I've known all my life people that have damaged themselves. I was a kind of athletic. I played sports. I was a construction worker, and, you know, along the way, you see people falling along the side as you're on the path. They just drop out like a marathon.
Yeah.
They're just falling away. And I didn't really give that much thought, not negatively, like, ha-ha.
Just like that couldn't possibly be you.
Yeah, just didn't occur to me what was happening to him. You know, a guy blows out his knee or, you know, cuts himself seriously or, you know, arm goes and, you know, things and you don't think about it. And then suddenly when it happened to me, it's like, oh, is this what they were talking about? My good fortune is that I had so many good years. So, you know, I always think back at I had a friend who's my best friend's cousin, which was his best family friend. And he'd been, you know, he was only 20 when he came back from Vietnam, and he was a paraplegic, and God, he was just unhappy.
Mm-hmm.
And I always thought about that. I was like, geez, you know, that, you know, how can you make him happy? I mean, he's in a wheelchair. And I didn't have that. And even now, whatever damage I have, I've had an interesting life. So I'm doing well. And hey, I'm here. I'm with you. What good things.
Well, you sort of explore this in your first story, Please Thank You, which is a story of a man who has had a stroke. Now, I know this is fiction, but there has to have been a lot of what you were feeling built into that story.
Well, definitely there's a tight parallel between me and the characters, Mr. Sanchez.
Sanchez, yeah.
And, we have a close story similarity. I obviously invented certain things to sort of highlight certain aspects of the situation. And, yeah, the characters. What's really always interesting to me about writing fiction is that when I take a really close story and it's a story that's really close to my own life, suddenly the fiction becomes seeming like the true events.
Mm-hmm.
And my memory changes. I remember the story events, which aren't real, better than I do the real events. It's a great thing that fiction does. It's art, what art does. It's fabulous.
It's almost like having to remember if you dreamed something or if it actually happened to you.
Yeah, it is very much like that. The interesting thing is the reality becomes the fiction, which isn't real, and the dream becomes the reality. Like, I don't know if that really happened that way. What I really think happened is if you read the story. And that is what I love about fiction, because even though the event might not be what we call factually true,
mm-hmm.
it is more true. It becomes more true, more real, and which is what myth always does. It's a deeper truth that we recognize more solidly, and maybe it's because there isn't cluttered with our personality anymore.
Do you think that's the same reason that readers go to fiction? I mean, obviously you're a reader of fiction yourself, but are we all looking to reinterpret things that somehow feel more real than the crazy stuff we're actually experiencing?
I really do think that we, you know, I have my bachelor's and master's are not in writing or English even. They're in religious studies, and I study religions. And what I loved about religions were myths. I like myth stories. And I actually think that's what I'm doing mostly. I'm trying to sort of call out in our daily life and in our times and, you know, in the times, in this little interval that I am on the earth, capturing the stories that come out, that distill. And, you know, I tend to use, you know, a lot of times I'll read people that I frankly think misunderstand me. They say that I'm a realist. And, you know, I think I understand why they're saying it, but
mm-hmm.
they don't understand that I'm using realism to tell a story, but I'm not a realist at all.
I would say the difference, and I am not a literary critic, but the difference between what you're doing and mythology is that myths explain things, but then they always moralize at the end. And you sort of leave us to decide for ourselves.
I think some myths, they may moralize, but usually they're really open to interpretation.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, when somebody goes down to the darkest places and climbs out, you know, the different stories that, you know, there definitely is a story about what happens to somebody, but I'm not sure that I don't do a similar thing. I don't really try to impose too much on it. I just try to tell the story. And it's interesting when you hear different people interpret stories. In a lot of respects, it's a Rorschach. They interpret the story, you know, like I had none of that in my mind, but they interpret the story in the way they see it.
I want to talk about this. Having grown up in El Paso, there are some Spanish words and phrases worked into the way the characters are speaking that I knew what they meant, but I wondered what I would have thought of these stories if I hadn't known the meaning of these words. And one that's always interesting to me is this word that can be defined in multiple ways, which is pocho or pocha. Can you talk about what you think about people who read you that don't know the words and what you expect to do with those?
Well, it's funny. It's a derogatory word. Usually it comes from a Mexican calls, you know, a Mexican-American, a pocho.
Who doesn't speak Spanish.
His Spanish is, you know, either non-existent or so bad that it might as well be non-existent. And sometimes it's not even that. The Spanish is so different, they're Americanized. Mm-hmm. So it essentially is what I am. So, you know, it's like a lot of negative words, you come to adopt them. You just take them on. Yeah, that's what I am. I'm a pocho. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you say it with pride. And a lot of the alternate usage that happened in the 70s and 80s, it's not as frequently used, but it's Chicano. Mm-hmm. It's sort of a negative word that was adopted by the Mexican-American community to say, look, we're Chicanos. We believe in ourselves. We have pride. We're not ashamed of who we are. We're not Mexicans. We're not Americans. Americans don't really like us. Mexicans don't really like us. We are our own community. And, you know, the newer, more comic way is pocho.
Mm-hmm. And is there a point at which you think Chicanos are choosing one identity or another for themselves? Because there's that factor. And then there's also the reality that other people are going to decide when they look at you or hear your name who they think you are.
Yeah, that one you really can't, I don't think you can do a lot about. You just sort of learn. Again, like the Rorschach, oh, this is what you think. And these, I go through that quite a bit. The stereotypes that come at me that I find interesting is I'll get reviews, in fact, that describe my work as masculine or macho mm-hmm. to the other extreme. And I'm like, well, why did that happen? I mean, yeah, I know. I mean, but nobody discusses Jonathan Franzen's point of view as male. Nobody,
although it definitely is.
It is male. But they don't really discuss it in the same way when you'll read reviews in the past, especially of me, of my work. Although this one is, we're not sure. It's like still early. But the masculinity is not such an issue. And so that seems good news to me. I think. And the other thing is the Latin lover sort of stereotype. Yeah. I deal with it, which is in certain respects a compliment, but at the same time, it's like, you know, not everything I'm doing is working at the groin level. And, you know, I do actually have a brain and I have an education and I didn't write a book in our books because that's my purpose.
It's not how you get girls.
Yeah. I mean, it's like the opposite of getting girls. It's mostly I'm alone mm-hmm. and I'm working real hard.
My guest is writer Dagoberto Gilb. His new book is called Before the End, After the Beginning. He's in town for a signing this evening at 6:30 at the Barnes & Noble store on Northwest Highway in Dallas. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can get online now at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, a multidisciplinary program that allows you the intellectual freedom to design your own master's degree. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is author Dagoberto Gilb. His new book is called Before the End, After the Beginning. He is also executive director of the Central Victoria Center for Mexican-American Literature and Culture. He's in town for a book signing tonight at 6:30 at the Barnes & Noble store on Northwest Highway in Dallas. If you'd like to be part of this conversation, you can call in to 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. Place is very specific in your stories, and it's not simply that you say, okay, this now we're in San Antonio, now we're in El Paso, now we're in Albuquerque. You're naming streets and intersections that people would recognize. Do you have to be familiar with a physical place to set a story there?
I absolutely believe that. I think place is as important as character. And not just as a device of lending authenticity to a fiction or a nonfiction even, I think it is the authenticity. I think you can't, just like you can't know a person until you know the shirt they're wearing, that person's wearing. I mean, it's details tell the reader, even without saying it, that this person knows what he or she is talking about. And I don't think you can avoid it. And, in the Southwest, it's almost, it verifies the, we know when somebody writes from Los Angeles and they don't know the freeways,
mm-hmm.
you immediately like,
it doesn't what feel else, real. Yeah.
What else don't you know?
Mm-hmm.
And what else are you just fudging on?
Well, the other interesting thing about you having moved to different places in the Southwest is that it means something different to be, if you want to say Chicano or Mexican-American, it means something different in El Paso than it means in Austin than it means in L.A.
Oh, truly. I mean, when I went to Austin at the time, the first time I went there was the most east I had ever been.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought of it as a southern town. I didn't even, where am I? This is not like anything I'd seen. And but then you start to find other people, the University of Texas is there, and you find that, it's a good school, so it brings a lot of people from what I consider the Southwest. I don't know if I do realize that Texas is, Texas is where the war was lost in the first place. And so we've been living with that reality since. But the Southwest, more or less ends, maybe at Marfa, maybe, mm-hmm. I still think of it as the, and then all the way to L.A., L.A. being the capital city of the Southwest.
How did you end up in El Paso after you had this master's degree in religious studies and you didn't get white-collar work right away at all?
No, I didn't. Well, my work-wise, I started working when I was 13. And so I was always working. I just assumed that was part of what I had to do to do myself. I had all kinds of jobs. But, El Paso, it's funny, in the old Los Angeles, I say the old because the current version, LA, is going through a huge immigrant movement. It really is changing the face of Los Angeles. But when I grew up, until the last 15 years, I'd say half of the Mexican-American people you met in Los Angeles were from El Paso, Juarez, Chihuahua.
Hmm.
I mean, people cross the border.
That's the big destination.
Turn left.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that was you don't go right, you mm-hmm. turn left. And so everybody is from, and in my own family, half of my family is from El Paso. Not my own blood, but I had an uncle whose wife was from El Paso, so we always heard of El Paso. And so it was always in my life. The other thing is my mother, who was terrified always, she was an undocumented person. She'd come across illegally in the 20s, I think, with her family. She was terrified of being deported. So on my birth certificate, it says that she was born in El Paso. On various documents, she used various American cities. I was telling someone recently this is after she passed, I was looking at some things she'd written, and on one thing she said she was born in Dallas. And I'm like, what a weird thing. I wonder where that came from. Because it's always under the influence of somebody she was talking to. So, yeah, so it was...
Was it the kind of thing that she would say to you, don't tell anybody what you know about where I'm from?
No, she didn't do that. But by the time I was old enough, my father and her were separated. My mother was very crazy, wild lady. And they just didn't work out. You know, I never even remembered my father in my home. But
you did know your father.
Yeah, no, he was good enough to give me a job. So he was the first one. He was a supervisor in an industrial laundry, which is where she came to know him. She grew up next door to the industrial laundry. And why was she next door? It's because my grandmother, her mother, was the mistress of the owner. And he'd set her up there. So they'd come, and that was the deal. And so my mother got to be working there for a brief time. My father, you know, he started working there when he was 13. So, and he was, you know, maybe 10 years older than her.
So I take it your parents didn't have anywhere near the level of education that you ended up with.
Oh, none. Mm-hmm. My father dropped out very young, you know, classic American story. I mean, I think he started working when he was 13.
And that was it. He just worked.
Yeah, he just worked. Mm-hmm. He was a very smart man. But you know, no education. My mother, I never verified whether she went to. I know she attended high school in downtown LA, but I don't believe she graduated.
So was that another element of your identity that you had to wrestle with as you were growing up? That you were different from your parents in the sense that you had sort of mixed ethnicity. You were also different from them in that you had greater educational aspirations and ultimately achievement. I mean, was that something you worried about?
Well, see, I didn't have educational aspirations. I had none, and I had no friends that had any. Mm-hmm. I mean, I grew up, we didn't know about education. You know, the big, you know, Harvard was a local junior college, going to LACC, mm-hmm. East LACC, or Long Beach City College. That was the big thing that you'd hear. Oh,
that's
really?
Where the Strivers were going.
That's it. That was the big news. Like, you went there and you got a good grade. Mm-hmm. And so I didn't have any of that. My era was, you know, Vietnam. And so I was just in the cusp where let's go to college, look at it. And, you know, I look back at my father, who was a Marine. He, you know, World War II Marine, a gung-ho big guy, fearless. And I don't know if he was a Republican or Democrat. I don't really think I knew him that well. Mm-hmm. But he was kind of fierce. But he, at some point, I do remember he was not, like, fond of the Vietnam War, which seemed unusual. And so he wasn't opposed to anybody not, you know, like, I think you should not go to that. I don't think that sounds like a good war to, you know, you don't want to just go join that. So I took that little pass. I took a pause, went to college and watched my deferment, you know, sort of took the school deferment. I was a bad student. I immediately got D's. And then they had me 1A. Mm-hmm. So that kind of caught my attention. I actually went to the induction center, and I remember that very well. And you looked around and said, oh, this is very serious. And, you know, I was kind of an athletic guy, and I thought, I don't think I want to be on this team. What would I do if I am drafted? I don't know where do I have to join the Marines? Do I have to? So then I went to the draft board, got a deferment again. I said, I'm going to go to school. And then the interesting thing was I like school. It wasn't something that my parents knew about. And actually, as I went along, they really didn't know what I was doing because I, you know, I didn't do the norm. At first, you know, I took like everybody that I knew. You'd study business, or I had friends that were fire science. You
know? Fire? So I don't even know what that
is.
Yeah,
I was to be a fireman. Oh. You know, they didn't know what to do. You know, they're just like, I think you go to school to this. And, you know, my stepfather at the time was a fireman. He didn't go to fire science. And so these sort of things were in my life. And, you know, the sort of things I thought we would do. Once I got into school, I absolutely fell in love with books. I didn't read. They weren't in my house. I didn't have a friend that read, but I was hungry. I didn't know how hungry I was for intelligence. And when I went to junior college, it was like every class was like the most exciting thing that could happen. I didn't even know what I could major in because I liked everything.
Huh. So what did it? What do you think was the difference between the way you were taught when you finally applied yourself and got into it, into school at junior college, and what you had learned, you know, for 12 years, 13 years before then?
You know, I've thought about it a lot. I joke. I think, did I have electroshock and I don't know it? I don't remember when they snapped and I just like, boom, what happened? Here I am. No, it was just some phenomena that happened and I read a book and it just changed me. I just couldn't believe that there were books that had things that were curious to me. I was starving for it and I fell in love. I just went on this journey. Now, it is also true that I was probably a mess. And a lot of my friends, you know, a lot of them didn't do good things and didn't end up well. And I could have gone this way and that way. And but I found myself, you know, a lot of people study psychology and things like that. I wanted to find out the answers to things. And, you know, eventually I ended up in philosophy because, hey, well, why is that? I wanted to go, you know, it's sort of like if you have a disease. Let's say you have cancer. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you talk to a doctor and he says, I think you got this. I think you got that. And like, I don't know if I trust you. I'm going to go to another doctor.
Yeah.
And finally, you go to MD Anderson. Mm-hmm. That's the best. And that's what I wanted. I wanted to go to the source. And when they said, we think you have this and this is what we know and this is what we don't. And that's what philosophy was for me is like, this is what they know, and this is what they don't. Okay, now I can kind of back off and go to the next subject.
So did you sort of go through the canon of English language literature once you decided you were a reader, or how did you choose what you wanted to read?
Oddly, I didn't start reading lit until I got out of school.
Hmm.
I studied philosophy and religion. However, I did take a lit. I was terrified of lit because I got D's. I did not do well in English in high school. If, you know, a different generation, I would have been one of these ones that was held back. I did not do well. Mostly not because I was stupid, but you know, I had other issues that I caused trouble. I was one of those troublemaker kids. And, you know, I was more interested in working and in cars, girls, and fights. I didn't care about school. In high school, I never took a book home. I didn't even know I didn't study, so I didn't do well. It wasn't like I could go to a good school, even if I knew they existed. It wasn't in my mind. So I was just doing those. What had happened is that once I started studying philosophy and things like that, I started realizing what I liked was stories. And then suddenly I started reading stories. And the next thing I knew, there I was.
Do you remember the first story you sat down to write?
Oh, actually, I think I do. Yeah, I wrote. Okay, the first thing I wrote was what became a very terrible novel. I just decided to write a novel. And it was a corny novel. It was just awful. But then I started learning about stories. I had the strange and wonderful coincidence. I was working a construction job at the University of Texas, El Paso. I was a carpenter at the museum there, and across the street, Raymond Carver had just gotten a job.
He was there like right before he got famous, essentially.
He had his first book. It was, you know, getting news, and so that's why they hired him.
Mm-hmm.
But he was literary famous, but he wasn't nationally known.
Mm-hmm.
And, and they said he was a working class writer, and I thought, wow, that's interesting because, you know, I'm working, you know. And so I read him, and he wrote stories, and he was getting all this attention. And once I saw that he could write stories, I started reading his stories, and my life just altered in that way. I started like, oh, okay, I'll write short stories. And I thought the business end of the writer thing was you wrote stories, you published the stories, and then they'd read your novel. And for, you know, about 3 years, I was under the delusion that the novel I'd written was really a great novel. And I look back at that and think I'm very happy that nobody gave me the truth, that it was really horrible. Mm-hmm. because I don't know if I could handle it. So I came to it slowly and gradually. Oh, it's pretty bad.
Was that a blow for you to realize completely on your own that it wasn't what you thought it was?
You know, it's sort of like looking at pictures of yourself and, you know, maybe you think, oh, look, I have big wide lapels or whatever it is. You think
in 1978, you're styling.
Yeah, you think you're like real cool. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, a few years later, you're like, oh, my God, I hope nobody sees that.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a lot like that. Anyway, going back to the question, my first story.
Yeah.
Long story short, I got a job teaching part-time at UTEP. I had a master's degree.
So you're working daytime during, like, on construction of the museum?
The construction job, not unlike often, I got fired because I have a mouth that mm-hmm. I caused trouble. I was only getting $5.50 an hour.
Mm-hmm.
And I started asking people, what are you making? And I'd find out who was making what. I was getting the second highest pay there. You know, this is my sort of, you know, rabble-rousing, unionizing thing is like, I started asking, and next thing I knew, I was being given a check. So it was very easy that I could get a job. I could take this part-time gig. But Ray Carver was there. I didn't know who he was, and I thought, I didn't know people took creative writing classes. So I decided, oh, he wants a story. I wrote him a story. It was called Down in the West Texas Town. Is about some junky construction workers who I knew, kind of like that life. I'd worked with guys like that who are heroin addicts in the evening, construction workers in the daytime. So that was my first attempt at the short story. I gave it to him. That story, he tried to get me into Iowa with that story, and I didn't even know what Iowa was.
We will talk more in just a moment with my guest for the hour, Dagoberto Gilb. His new book is called Before the End, After the Beginning. He's in town for a book signing this evening at 6:30 at the Barnes & Noble store on Northwest Highway in El Paso. If you've got a question, we do have lines open at 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, a graduate education flexible enough to allow you to explore what matters most to you. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is author Dagoberto Gilb. His new book of short stories is called Before the End, After the Beginning. He's in town for a book signing this evening at 6:30 at the Barnes & Noble store on Northwest Highway in Dallas. If you would like to join the conversation, call us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. So I want to talk about this story that you have in the book called Cheap, which is about this musician who's living in Austin, and he needs to hire some painters. Can you give us a little bit of the setup, and then we'll talk about the story?
Yeah, the musician, he's a classical guitar player, and, you know, he decides to, paint his house. So he's looking for the least expensive, the cheapest person that can do it, and you learn that he's kind of having some physical things too. He's going blind.
Mm-hmm.
And so he's struggling with that. So he looks around and he finds this guy, Luke. And Luke comes, gives him a bid. And it's an incredibly cheap bid. And he's very happy. And Luke has some undocumented workers come in and paint the house.
And it's such a subtle story, and there's so things working on so many different levels. Because on the one hand, this character, the musician, likes the fact that he's living in Austin, and although he's Mexican American, people like Luke think it's cool that he does what he does, and he gets a lot of respect. On the other hand, he can't help in some ways but relate to the fact that undocumented workers who are abused had in some ways just the bad fortune of being born on the wrong side of the border.
Yeah, it's sort of a, you know your family, and he knows his family. And so a lot of people are, you know, if you're a Mexican-American, you know about the, you know, where people have come from, different, you know, people. In El Paso and Los Angeles, we meet, you know, you know undocumented people. People have just crossed. They're part of your daily life. And you know, when people sort of disrespect them, you're sensitive. Like, you know, somebody in your own family, well, wait a minute, that's my cousin you're talking about.
Mm-hmm. We have an email here from Alice in Dallas who wants to know how old you were when you first started writing.
Oh, God, I was not young. Some people, you know, a lot of times you hear these people, they'll talk about they started writing when they came out of the womb. I'm like, let me have a pen. And I got to tell this story. Not me. I had no idea. So I was probably in my mid, later 20s when I decided to take up a story.
Did you think, I have something to say here? Or did you just find these stories inhabiting your brain and you had to get them out?
Both. Mm-hmm. And but a lot of it, you know, is the same sort of thing, the same rabble-rousing, you know, organizing. Like when I go to a job and I say, why is this guy, because he's not a citizen, getting, he has seven kids and he's been working for you for, you know, 19 years, I remember, and you're paying him $450. I come on, you pay me $550, and the other guy's getting $6. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's like, well, isn't this guy a really good worker? And why aren't you paying him? It's the same sort of thing that brought that to, I brought it to fiction. I thought you could tell these stories of people. And a lot of what my own sense is that I realize that there's a world that isn't discussed. And, yeah, we don't read about the people, especially in the Southwest. We don't see these characters in American lit. And I early along said, no, I want all these people to exist. I had trouble. My first collection was rejected because, you know, I remember an editor wrote me back and said, wow, this work reminds me of fiction from the 30s. And I thought, wow, thank you. But that's what he was rejecting. That was why they wouldn't publish it. And I thought, well, that's funny because, and then, you know, the other thing was like, why are all these construction workers? That's not the thing we know about Mexicans or Chicanos. And I'm like, well, have you been to a job site? Yeah. Have you been to a factory? And no, they really had not appeared. They did not exist in lit yet.
I know that you take the label, if you want to call it that, of Chicano writer with pride. On the other hand, does it bother you that people think these are stories for other Chicanos to read, as opposed to what you just said, this phrase, American literature?
I actually fought that quite a bit at the beginning. And if you look at my first book, I would tell them, no, Jack Kerouac isn't a French-American writer. He's an American writer. And I'm an American writer. I write about the Southwest, and you can talk about my heritage, but it's just a very confusing thing. Over the years, I have particularly learned how I, you know, again, the Rorschach, the perception, and I see the Mexican-American, the Latino from the Southwest, we don't really exist in American lit. It's very rare that you see us in the mainstream. Even in bookstores, I've given bookstore readings, you know, big crowds. And then I come back and they put me in Latin America. And like, what happened? Why did that happen? Why aren't I in this?
Larry McMurtry is not in the Latin America section.
Exactly. And, you know, it's just some strange thing that the perception, they see the name, they don't know what to do. And so at some level, it's like not, you know, you do it because you have to. You sort of fight off the label. At the same time, if you're not going to allow me to be American, I'm going to embrace the people that do allow me to exist.
There's a story, and forgive me because I don't remember the title at this minute. It's toward the end of the book, and it's a young couple, and they've gone out to dinner with their next-door neighbors.
Oh.
And the young man is Mexican-American, his girlfriend is Anglo, and the two next-door neighbors are Anglo. And the neighbors get a little bit tipsy, and they go driving, and the guy gets pulled over. And it's not even like a big deal. This is what I thought was so fascinating about this story, is that the narrator, who is the Mexican-American young man, says, if that had been me, I would have been thrown in jail and whatever. And this guy just sort of got off with a handshake and a wave to the cop.
Yeah, it's sort of that Eddie Murphy skit. I don't know if you ever remember the Eddie Murphy skit where he walks into the bus and...
Oh, he's dressed as a white person. Yeah.
No, at first the black person, and then as soon as he leaves... You know, it's like a party as soon as all the white people are there. And it's sort of like, well, what is going on when I'm not around? Mm-hmm. And yeah, that and I think we all do talk about that. There's a different, and you know, I mean, a policeman would say, well, you know, it's because of the history and the stats. And so there is an explanation, but you do notice.
And do you think now, being a published writer and working in academia, do you have a glimpse into what's going on when theoretically before you weren't in the room?
Wow, yes, I often feel like a spy. I mean, in my case in particular, because, you know, I mean, not only all my life, I could pass some people, oh, you're Spanish, or you're Greek, or you're Italian. So a lot of these things are going on. But in the literary business, it is, I guess, you know, here's this big word, it's attenuated. It's, mm-hmm. it's brought out and heightened. You see it more and more, and like what we aren't, or we are not getting. You know, one of the big books right now is Jeffrey Eugenides' book. Is it The Marriage Plot? Mm-hmm. And that is taken as an utterly American story, a part of American lit. It's set at Brown University, and you know, for I think it's all, you know, kind of an interesting that it's Brown University.
Which is a very rarefied environment, I think is what you're getting at.
It's incredibly not very American at all. Mm-hmm. And yet the literary industry just accepts him as an American writer. And somebody like me is sort of the, well, you're on the periphery. You live in the Southwest and all this stuff. And it's like, well, how do you determine that Brown is America? Which, of course, it's, you know, talking about the 1% America, mm-hmm. is utterly privileged. And yet you don't question that is any, I mean, my experience of the America is much more ordinary. Work and living in El Paso, Los Angeles, Austin. I actually live like everybody, and yet I'm kind of always defending where I write from.
You know, I wonder, though, if you were to switch your subjects and keep their ethnicity the same, but you were writing about doctors and lawyers and university presidents, which we know exist in the Chicano world, if anybody would publish your books, because they would think that doesn't exist.
Yeah, no, it'd be a little far-fetched. I expect that wouldn't look right. Mm-hmm. You know, but I do wonder, you know, sort of people expect, you know, people say, well, why don't you write about rich people? And I'm like, well, you... Give me money and I'll write from a rich point of view. I'd love to write. I'd like to know it, but I don't know how to do that. I know that wealthier people, wealthier writers can imagine poverty. The bedroom may have 100 things, and they imagine poverty as 3 things, a bed, a lamp, a chair. Mm-hmm. And they think they can do it and get offended if you say, you can't write from this point of view if you don't know it. And they really... take offense when you say that, but that's what a lot of times it used to be called colonialism, when you can imagine another culture, but you're always talking about the other culture from the heightened.
Yeah, it's like in reference to your culture, what makes it poor.
Right.
Yeah. You actually have a great description in the book. A guy goes back to visit his high school sweetheart, and she grew up very poor, and now she's married to this rich guy. And the description of her childhood bedroom, I thought, was so evocative. And look, I grew up middle class. I didn't have that experience, but it really helped me to understand what that situation would be. And having lived in El Paso, I passed by homes where that was probably the case.
No, well, that's great. I'm just pleased that you say that. I think we all, I mean, if you grew up in El Paso or L.A. and you know the poorest, I never felt like the poorest. Mm-hmm. I was like lower middle. I mean, potentially, if my mother and father hadn't divorced, we'd have done better. But I was the house that started off good on the corner, but my mother, being the Mexican, left there. It was like we were the one who didn't mow the lawn right and all the yard work wasn't right. It was kind of a funkier house. So we were always noticed.
Were you, I mean, did you have a really honest relationship with your mom? Was it the sort of thing where you could say anything on your mind to her?
Oh, God, almost too much. But my mother was kind of a, well, on the one hand, she was a bit of a drunk. Mm-hmm. She was a party girl. And that's putting it badly. But she was also tons of fun, just so much energy and spirit. Everybody loved her. Everybody wanted to be around her all the time, which kind of drove me crazy. I didn't like it. So those are the good parts of her, is just always the life of the party and everybody. And then, you know, sometimes you just want some quiet. I always would think of my mother as like the sun.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, you love it. But, God, I wanted to get dark because I wanted to sleep.
Now, you need a break sometimes.
Yeah, and my father, who I didn't know, was like darkness. Mm-hmm. And I was like, can we have some sunlight? It's just like, you know, it's getting moldy. It's just not good in here.
Is there anything you miss at all about not having to work another job besides writing and some teaching?
Oh, God, I often, not now, at this stage, it's finally has, and that's been the good thing, is I'm happy with what I've got. But when I first gave up construction, I really worried that I would lose something essential to me, mm-hmm. to who I was. But now it's much better. But yeah, I'm happy with it now. I think what happened when I used to teach, I didn't feel comfortable. And I often think, couldn't I just have like a 30-hour a week, maybe 3 days a week in a factory? I'm much happier working with people and being around the world instead of discussing the world in sort of a classroom. I really had it took me years to adjust to the discussion of the love life. And in fact, the students, you know, my whole way of coming to writing was through experiences in life and living and jobs. And they, you know, bless them for this, is they talk about books.
Mm-hmm.
And I like books, but books, when I read, they make me remember things. They make me remember people, and they remember books. And it's like, I don't get that, but...
So when you really have something invested in a student and you think he or she has some potential, is your advice to them, take a year off and go work at some blue-collar job?
I used to think that, go live, but uh-huh. I don't know anymore. I feel like I don't know the answer. You just find your way. I've had quite a few of my students have published and done well, and there's all kinds of ways to the climb a mountain, so I know that. And, you know, different people have different stories, and I like that. I absolutely get that now, so it's a wonderful thing that we live like that, and so it's all fine.
Well, Dagoberto Gale, thank you so much for spending this hour with us. I really appreciate it.
Oh, excuse me. Thank you.
The new book is called Before the End, After the Beginning. There will be a book signing this evening at 6:30 at the Barnes & Noble store on Northwest Highway in Dallas. My name is Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.
Think production team includes engineer Nilofer Arsala. Our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about today's show, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcasts at kera.org/think. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org.